Nous allons maintenant voyager de l'autre côté des États-Unis et écouter Donna Murch, professeure d'histoire à Rutgers University. Elle travaille sur la lutte des droits civiques et l'histoire du maintien de l'ordre et des prisons aux États-Unis. Elle est l'auteur de Living for the City, Migration, Education and the Rise of the Black Panther Party in Oakland, California. Et elle va nous parler de la couleur de la guerre, la question raciale, le néolibéralisme et les sanctions pénales à Los Angeles à la fin du XXe siècle.
Thank you very much for that introduction. I'd like to thank Andrew Diamond and the other organizers. It's really an honor to be here with my esteemed colleagues, Mary Patillo and Tom Segru, and many of the people sitting in the audience. This paper is taken from a new book project. It's a brand new project called Crack in Los Angeles, Policing the Crisis and the War on Drugs. And this paper really looks at the war on drugs and war on gangs and thinks about the constraints against of mobilizing against it posed by the neoliberal city. To many, Los Angeles has long represented a failed urbanism, an unplanned collection of disjointed and alienated suburbs in search of a city. According to one popular historian, it embodies a dystopic vision of an urban future devoid of public space and governed by militarized and market-driven logic. Indeed, the spatial turn in the social sciences treated Los Angeles not only as a place, but as a concept that epitomized the unfolding of a new set of processes that forged the contemporary neoliberal metropolis. At the same time, its position at the apex of the Sun Belt in post-war America has set LA apart from the decaying urban cores of the Rust Belt and the Midwest, and generated an economic gravity of its own. Los Angeles is an immensely wealthy metropolitan region with the United States' largest manufacturing sector that spans five counties, Los Angeles, Orange, Ventura, Riverside, and San Bernardino. Urban planning scholar Edward Soja argued that its propulsive and uneven growth epitomized the working of the 20th century capitalism itself. In 1989, he described the city as the capital of capital, a place where it all comes together. In revisiting the city, nearly 30 years after its notoriety as a failed experiment in unchecked growth, real estate investment, defense production, and extractive industry, it is clear that Los Angeles now has the unfortunate distinction of being the United States' largest urban site of mass incarceration. If one includes the full carceral archipelago of jails, detention centers, holding facilities, the city of LA houses more prisoners than any city on the planet. Along with its surrounding counties and other embattled municipalities of Southern California, Los Angeles has pioneered new instruments for police militarization, anti-drug campaigns, youth criminalization, and anti-gang prosecution that influenced and anticipated developments in other parts of the country and even the world. Arguably, in the decades since the Watts Rebellion of 1965, the city has waged continuous domestic warfare on its poorest and most vulnerable citizens, who are overwhelmingly composed of black and brown youth. The city's overlapping wars on drugs and gangs offers us a window onto the convergence between the United States' punishment regime and neoliberal social policy at the end of the 20th century. One of the most surprising developments in recent scholarship is how separate these two research clusters remain. Although popular historian Mike Davis saw them as integral, the academic literature that has emerged over the past decade has often viewed them as separate and distinct. And this is especially true for historians, I think less so for sociologists, but really they remain quite separate research clusters. The former has largely emphasized a global movement towards trade liberalization, pro-market governance, deunionization, privatization, and social welfare retrenchment. While the latter, that is the history, the emerging field of carceral history, has focused on domestic racial politics in the US, comparisons between the 1970s and post-Reconstruction after the Civil War, so the system of convict leasing that accompanies essentially the backlash against African-American enfranchisement and then mass incarceration in the late 70s, debates about the new right versus bipartisan support for law and order, the utility of punishment campaigns for increasing state power, and the criminalization of youth in response to the mass social movements of the 1960s and 1970s. By focusing on Los Angeles's war on drugs and gangs in the late decades of the 20th century, this paper reflects on how we might integrate the two. So what I'm going to do is basically provide an overview of the war on drugs and gangs and then try to think about some moments that it might intersect with ideas of neoliberalism. In Los Angeles, punitive campaigns against drugs and gangs rationalized a new martial infrastructure. The ultimate carceral effects of this mass criminalization can hardly be overstated. From 1977, the California Department of Corrections, the CDC, prison population increased from roughly 20,000 to 162,000 in the year 2000, with over 40% drawn from Los Angeles alone and 70% from Southern California more generally. By 1990, drug offenses composed 34.2% of new admissions to California prisons and 25% of the detainees in Los Angeles County Jail, which contained the world's largest urban prison population. By the year 2000, the combined totals of blacks and Latinos made up over 64% of the total population of the California CDC. Furthermore, African Americans composed only 6.7% of California's general population, but made up 31% of state prisoners. Major components of Los Angeles Police Department, the LAPD, the Los Angeles Sheriff's Department, LASD, and the California Highway Patrol's militarized infrastructure could be traced to law enforcement's hostile response to the civil unrest of the post-war years. In the aftermath of the Watts Rebellion, the LAPD's use of military-grade hardware and elite tactical units originated in the department's self-described counterinsurgency campaigns against black and brown power organizations. The department founded SWAT, Strategic Weapons Assault Team, with a compact force of former military veterans in 1967. Subsequently, the LAPD deployed SWAT for the first time against the Southern California Black Panther Party and their office at 41st and Central in 1969. So the idea is that they're taking these kind of counterinsurgency forces, all coming as veterans from Vietnam, and applying this technology to domestic policing. And Daryl Gates, Chief Daryl Gates, who's later the chief during the Los Angeles Rebellion of 92, is the architect of SWAT. The commando force used a tank on loan from the National Guard and won Department of Justice authorization for a grenade launcher. SWAT marked a new era in Los Angeles law enforcement, which steadily expanded its use of elite tactical units at the expense of rank-and-file police officers. With funding from the federal agency, Law Enforcement Assistance Administration, the LEAA, the department created the Total Resources Against Street Hoodlums, TRASH, 5 years later. Under community protest, it was later renamed CRASH, Community Resources Against Street Hoodlums, and went on to become one of the city's most notorious anti-gang units in the 1980s, along with the LASD's Operation Safe Streets, OSS, and the District Attorney's Hardcore Drug Unit, soon following in their wake. As this list of martial alphabet agencies implies, starting with the invention of SWAT, LA helped lead the national march towards police militarization. And here, I think the names say it all. So you get even the district attorney is you have a core group of lawyers that call themselves the hardcore drug unit. So this martial, militarized vision of the war on drugs. In addition to personal restructuring that funneled more manpower and funding towards elite commando units, one of the most striking features of departmental militarization was the LAPD's attempt to expunge all social service components from policing and to focus exclusively on crime and territorial control. Geographic dispersion of the city and the establishment of the LAPD's Air Support Division, the AASD, in 1974 became the world's largest airborne municipal law enforcement system in the world, and it contributed to tactical surveillance and distance from city residents. While William Parker's vision of professionalization in the post-war years laid the foundation for this approach, under the auspices of President Ronald Reagan's intensified wars on crime, drugs, and gangs, the martial imperative grew stronger and received larger increases in funding, especially through asset forfeiture, which I'll be talking about later, and direct support from municipal, state, and federal government. So to highlight a point also that Mary made, that I think that really, in thinking about the militarization of policing in LA, much of this predates the neoliberal era. So we're tracing it back to the period under William Parker, who's the mentor for Daryl Gates, and it's a part of long-term patterns of racialized policing, but you see an intensification in the 1980s. Los Angeles's high-profile war on drugs reflected the larger policies and strategic aims of Reagan's national punishment campaign, including saturation policing, eradication of youth gangs, asset forfeiture, federalization of drug charges, and strict enforcement of mandatory minimum sentencing. At the street level, the use of massive police sweeps with spectacular displays of overwhelming force embodied the city's militarized vision of law enforcement, as did Chief Daryl Gates' repeated call to arms. Testifying on the one-year anniversary of the Bush administration's war on drugs, the LAPD police chief told the Senate Judiciary Committee, quote, the casual drug user ought to be taken out and shot. Behind this bombastic rhetoric lay a larger neoliberal truth. In an era of drastic reduction of social services and deindustrialization, mass incarceration, fueled by anti-drug and anti-gang campaigns, became de facto urban social policy for the residents of impoverished communities like South Central and Pico Union. And the geographic application of this is important. It's targeted towards specific neighborhoods, especially towards South Central and Pico Union. The prescription for widespread joblessness and the illicit economies that accompanied urban divestment was simply to remove a significant percentage of the population from the streets through prison warehousing. Tellingly, in 1980, prior to the advent of the alleged crack epidemic and Reagan's declaration of a new war on drugs, Chief Daryl Gates argued that the rate of 0.1%, so 0.1% incarceration of California's population in 1980, 26,000 people, was insufficient. He advocated that in order to achieve public safety, 2 to 3% of the population should be incarcerated, so a 20 to 30-fold increase. In Los Angeles, much of the carceral infrastructure for the city's war on drugs relied on geographically targeted gang sweeps together with anti-gang legislation and prosecution tools. The conflation of drug crimes with street gang membership created a comprehensive net for the criminalization of non-white youth. Drawing on a repertoire of historical demonologies with their own prosecutorial regimes, the LAPD alternately viewed black and Latino gangs, street gangs, through the lens of organized crime or terrorism. The slippage from street gangs to drug trafficking, organized crime, and terrorism represented the defining principle of the Reagan-Bush era war on drugs. Its solution was total suppression and use of RICO conspiracy prosecutions to remove as many alleged gang members from the streets as possible. So one of the primary ways the war on drugs is fought is through the war on gangs. And you have this kind of moral panic about gangs in Los Angeles, which was repeated by the national media. So the focus is really on talking about gang members, but it's, I think it veiled the processes that lay behind the drug war. Between 1984 and 1988, California passed over 80 separate anti-gang measures and developed powerful new legal tools, including the civil gang injunction and gang enhancements in sentencing. In December 1987, Los Angeles City Attorney and future Mayor James Hahn pioneered anti-gang injunctions use against the Playboy gangster Crips in West Los Angeles. Gang injunctions permanently prohibited members from engaging in specified behaviors in a designated geographic area. The prosecuting agency sued a gang as an unincorporated association in order to allow for the continual addition of new names. Injunctions' civil nature also meant that the state was not required to provide a public defender. So they function essentially like a restraining order without end. Defining the war on drugs as a war on gangs justified the criminalization of everyday life in black and brown Los Angeles. Modes of dress, movement, color of shoelaces, hand gestures, and mere association became defined as prosecutable offenses. Gang injunctions worked in tandem with municipal, state, and federal databases. In 1985, the LASD, the sheriffs, created its own computerized list, gang reporting, evaluation, and tracking system. Great. The acronym is great. 7 years later, the Federal General Accounting Office revealed that the sheriffs listed 47% of all African American men in LA between the ages of 21 and 24 as gang members. Racially targeted policing combined with a denial of legal representation made it virtually impossible for youth to have their names removed. In this sense, anti-gang injunctions also contained a brutal class component. Their success hinged on their target's inability to hire lawyers. And this was very conscious. This is why it was made civil, that essentially that the kinds of population that were targeted were so poor they couldn't afford lawyers, and if they could, their names easily could have been removed. While anti-gang injunctions and databases provide mechanisms for surveillance, control, and admission of large numbers of minority youth into the system for minor offenses, gang enhancement legislation ultimately had the most damaging effects for mass incarceration. In 1988, the California legislature passed the Street Terrorism and Prevention Act, STEP, which mandated that persons convicted of crimes who have been designated as gang members for additional charges and sentencing. In the initial 1988 law, prosecutors could enhance gang members' convictions from 1 to 5 years of additional time per offense. Subsequently, California's Proposition 21 amended the STEP Act in 2000 by increasing gang enhancements to 16 months to 5 years for nonviolent offenses and to 10, 15, 20, and 25 years to life for violent offenses. Moreover, in first-degree murder cases with special circumstances, Prop 21 mandated the death penalty or life imprisonment without the possibility of parole. The dense layering of STEP and its subsequent revisions included added prison time for gun charges and for crimes committed within 1,000 yards of a school. This meant that it was not uncommon for very young offenders to receive multiple consecutive life sentences. Los Angeles's repressive legal regime worked in tandem with law enforcement's spectacular shows of force, mass arrests, and saturation policing. After the murder of Karen Toshima, the LAPD proclaimed 1988 the year of gang enforcement. Quote, "This is war," declared Daryl Gates. "We want to get the message out to the cowards out there that we're going to come and get them." With this battle cry, the department sent over 1,000 officers into South LA in conjunction with Operation Hammer. On Saturday, April 9th, 1988, the police set up an impromptu holding facility in the parking lot of the Los Angeles Coliseum and proceeded to arrest over 1,400 people, including more African American youth than in any single incident since Watts. So there actually wasn't enough space in the Los Angeles County Jail, so they set up this impromptu facility in the parking lot of the Coliseum. Over the course of the next 6 months, law enforcement jailed over 18,000 people, declaring over half of the arrests as gang-related. Okay, so now I'd like to talk about how does this story of punishment and domestic warfare fit in with a larger history of neoliberalism's advance. The first and most striking element is the reallocation of municipal and federal resources from a social state to a penal state, to use one of Loic Vauquant's earlier formulations. This took two forms. One, a shift in federal financing from social provision to punishment, and secondly, the expanded use of the privatization of costs through civil asset forfeiture. So the way that asset forfeiture works is that if you're accused of a drug crime, not convicted but accused, the state has the right to seize the contents of your wallet, your car, your house, your boat. The state can seize your own personal property. Historically, Los Angeles had a comparatively small social welfare infrastructure like other Western cities in the US that contrasted with the better developed urban bureaucracies of Eastern Seaboard and Midwestern cities. This lack of capacity was further exacerbated by the oil shocks and tax revolts of the 1970s. Los Angeles Mayor Tom Bradley relied on federal grants to pay for up to 75% of the city's social welfare expenditures. However, when federal monies were cut under the Reagan administration, service delivery plummeted while funding for law enforcement strongly increased. This reallocation of resources was aided by the use of civil forfeiture, in which persons accused not convicted of drug crimes could have their personal property seized. This privatization of police funding netted the LAPD between $10 and $15 million per year during the 1980s. Indeed, they took in so much money that there was uncertainty about exactly how to spend it in the late 80s. The second issue for thinking about how neoliberalism and the carceral state converge is considering the strength of the police unions, who were really able to protect their workers from the downward push on wages and unionization that were suffered in other parts of the economy. Like the military, law enforcement was insulated from the larger assaults on private and public sector workers. Indeed, their numbers significantly increased, as did pay and compensation. The third issue for bringing together neoliberal analysis with historical study of the carceral state is a harder one, both in terms of periodization and analysis. Namely, how do we explain the overwhelmingly racialized nature of the war on drugs in the late 20th century Los Angeles and other American cities? As the work of Khalil Mohammed and others has shown, the criminalization of African Americans is an enduring thread of US history that both predates and postdates the New Deal social welfare state. The emergence of mass incarceration in the war on drugs and gangs in the late 70s taps into earlier social cleavages and accelerates this process rather than inaugurating it. Arguably, the mass criminalization of Black, Brown, and Indigenous populations is a change in degree rather than in kind. In other words, it cannot simply be attributed exclusively to the larger neoliberal shift and its negative effects on the poor. In the case of the LAPD, the anti-Black bias and targeting of leftists and other radical activists under Chief Parker's reign from 1950 to 1966 profoundly influenced subsequent policing practices in the war on drugs, gangs, and so-called street terrorists. And again, as I mentioned, Parker is the mentor for Chief Daryl Gates. That is not to say that neoliberalism did not have important effects on black and brown communities. Perhaps most strikingly, it undercut the ability of those most affected by the wars on drugs and gangs to mobilize effectively against these punishment campaigns. Legal scholar Dorothy Roberts developed an important formulation to try to explain why African-American women advocates she interviewed from the contemporary foster care system simultaneously embraced more punitive controls on foster parents and greater financial subsidy. Quote, "I came to realize that this apparent paradox reflects the consequences of neoliberal social reforms. As these neighborhoods are stripped of social programs in the government's shift to market solutions for poverty, residents must increasingly rely on more punitive institutions to meet their needs." So one of the paradoxes that I think Los Angeles presents in the 1980s is that even the populations that are most affected by the war on drugs and gangs, there's relatively little opposition that's visible. And the question is why. So one, this is kind of, it's a new system of control. So I think it takes a while for people to actually figure out how to mobilize. People are disoriented, the amount of violence and the scale of the war on drugs and war on gangs. I think that's part of the story. But I also think it reflects some of the larger political culture of the era. The history of Black Los Angeles offers some compelling insights into why even communities most affected by punishment campaigns initially embraced them. During the 1980s, much of the discourse from black politicians and the press centered on the crisis of the crack epidemic. So it's really seen as a crisis of addiction and sale, rather than on the repressive apparatus of the wars on drugs and gangs. In Los Angeles, at the epicenter of the crack economy, the scale of panic engendered can hardly be overestimated. In 1989, Congresswoman Maxine Waters declared, quote, "The most urgent problem facing ghettoized African Americans today is the lethal infestation of drugs in our community," end quote. Although the solutions that Waters sought emphasized social welfare and public health for troubled neighborhoods reeling from Reagan-era divestment, unwittingly, the lens of crisis strengthened law enforcement's justification for the drug war and provided it with a thin humanitarian veil. So one interesting shift that takes place is that you begin to see, after the LA rebellion, more organized forms of resistance emerging from the drug war, emerging against the drug war. However, they're still operating within particular constraints. African-American class politics in the era of neoliberalism proved integral to community approaches to the drug wars. Historically, black Angelenos had the largest interracial income gap nationally, and economic disparity shaped how different strata understood the war on drugs. You have an organization that emerges called the Southern California Organizing Committee, SCOC, and the East Los Angeles United Neighborhood Organization, UNO, and they co-sponsored protests in South LA. Formed in 1982 by a network of churches, SCOC demands revealed a mixture of law and order politics with maternalist advocacy for social welfare and youth programs. Given historic fights for adequate policing and higher rates of violent crime in South LA, African Americans were six times more likely to be killed by homicide than whites. Their concerns were not surprising. Nevertheless, the hallmarks of militarized law enforcement remained unmistakable in their punitive vision of reform. SCOC and UNO advocated establishing combat zone teams drawn from multiple law enforcement agencies to target gangs and drug trafficking in high crime areas, higher taxes on liquor to pay for more police, increases in federal drug agents in Los Angeles, and perhaps most importantly, building a black and brown coalition to force local officials to provide more police protection. In the context of massive cuts to American cities under the Reagan administration, carceral solutions to the problems of impoverished communities had much greater efficacy than redistributive liberalism. Rather than approaching the problem from the standpoint of public health or structural inequality, deindustrialization, outsourcing, capital flight, etc., these early reformers looked to the problems and contradictions inside impoverished neighborhoods themselves. Christian churches in particular played an important role in advocating for more punitive self-help approaches. Exploring how welfare retrenchment, militarized law enforcement, and its crisis-driven rationale fostered an increasingly conservative grassroots politics of personal responsibility is an understudied theme, not only in the history of Los Angeles, but throughout Black America in the era of the war on drugs and mass incarceration. The state effectively co-opted much of the anger and disorientation created by the Reagan-era urban crisis into an anti-crime framework that blamed the alleged, quote, pathological culture of black and brown youth for the problems of poverty and urban divestment. Los Angeles's sharp interracial class divide exacerbated this tendency, which targeted the poor and most vulnerable members of the community. So SCOC and UNO are just one voice. There are multiple voices involved. What you see after the LA Rebellion is the prominence of, I would call them more progressive and grassroots approaches to opposing the drug war. The most important is the Coalition Against Police Abuse, CAPA. But CAPA has its roots in the Black Power movement. Its founder is Michael Zinzin, who was a Pasadena Panther. And he won successful suits against the LAPD for police brutality. He actually lost an eye in the late 70s after having been beaten by the Pasadena police. So he had a track record of fighting the LAPD and winning legal cases. And CAPA, along with some other civil liberty organizations, actually succeeded in having the intelligence division of the LAPD disbanded in the early 80s. But one of the paradoxes is that CAPA is really not able to attract a mass base. SCOC and UNO are able to have these giant anti-crime rallies in the mid-80s. But after the LA Rebellion, CAPA is able to put together, they work together to create a gang truce and to try to build a broader, more progressive coalition against the war on drugs. Another tendency that emerges is the Community Coalition Against Substance Abuse, which is founded by Karen Bass, who's the future congresswoman, the future congresswoman from Los Angeles. And it's a not-for-profit that she assembles in the early 90s. It advocated for mandatory school counseling, drug gang diversion programs, and utilizing forfeiture seizure monies, this is their language, to finance drug treatment. Karen Bass described their mission. Our mission essentially is to address the drug and alcohol problems of the community. Quote, we don't do that by providing direct services or treatment or counseling, but we do that by organizing and empowering community residents to change the environment that creates drug and alcohol problems in the first place. So their most sustained form of activism essentially is trying to prevent liquor stores from reopening and having community members march through the neighborhood trying to shut down open-air sex and drug markets. So it was really a behaviorally based approach to the problems of the drug epidemic. While they talked about public health approaches, there really was an attempt to try to provide direct services, but rather to become part of a policy research and advocacy. So I think that in itself might be looked at through a neoliberal lens. It's certainly a break from Michael Zinzin, who's seeking for ways to set up direct treatment, drug treatment programs. Okay, so to conclude, I think it is important to tell the history of the Coalition Against Police Abuse and other working class and progressive approaches to the drug war. It's difficult history to document. CAPA does have a well-developed archive. Other places do not. But many of the not-for-profits, which become important, the not-for-profits and community development programs, they really overshadow the grassroots organizations themselves. And so I think in a lot of the new literature that's emerging on the carceral state, it's focused on not-for-profits and on community development corporations. But CAPA offered a sharp contrast to the more neoliberal forms of protest politics represented by the community coalition and corporatist neighborhood advocacy organizations like SCOC and UNO, who have subsequently emerged as supporters of school charterization. Together with the Mothers Reclaim Our Children, which was a Mothers of Incarcerated Men grassroots organization, and the California Gang Truce, CAPA and its network of grassroots radicals embodied a historical shift as poor and working class populations of color who suffered the worst effects of LA's militarized drug wars began mobilizing against gang suppression and mass incarceration. Far to the left of black elected officials, the local clergy, and traditional civil rights activists, these new political formations raise a number of compelling issues for studying the different forms of corporate and foundation-funded groups, not-for-profits, and grassroots opposition to the carceral state, all of whom were forced to reckon with neoliberal incentives and constraints. As the first generation of history is written about black protest in the neoliberal era, Los Angeles's war on drugs and gangs is instructive. The city embodied many of the period's worst aspects, and because of, and despite this history, or perhaps because of it, produced some of its most compelling opposition.
Thank you.